So, hi everyone. I think everyone probably knows me. I'm a postdoc at PI. So today I will be telling you about. So normally I talk about work that was published already. So this is the first time I'm talking about something that hasn't been published. So there are some details missing and so on. All questions are appreciated. All criticisms are appreciated because this is brand new. So I'll be talking about motion as the infinitesimal limit of quantum teleportation. The outline of the talk is I'll first review standard teleportation and port-based teleportation protocol, and then we'll go into the infinitesimal limit of quantum teleportation. We'll see what I mean by that when we get to that point. The ingredients that go into this work are we talk about the entanglement in the vacuum of a quantum field. We need to use the port-based teleportation protocol to take the infinitesimal limit. This will lead us to a notion of massive and massless Brownian motion, and finally to quantum random walks, and we'll see what conclusions we can make from that. And finally, at the end, if I have time, I will talk about a different teleportation protocol which comes from superoscillations, but we might not get to that. Okay, so I guess everyone is interested in this part, so I've just given a teaser, but let's start with the introduction. So just to introduce teleportation, probably everyone here knows what the standard teleportation protocol is. In general, to do teleportation, you need some entanglement resource. You need to perform a measurement and then send some classical information from Alice to Bob so that Bob can reconstruct the state that Alice used to have. Roughly speaking, these are the ingredients one needs for teleportation. In the end, there's also, I added in brackets, unitary correction. So in the standard teleportation protocol, you need to perform some unitary operation in order to get the exact state that you started with. So in pictures, we have Alice and Bob. Alice has an unknown state psi that she wants to send to Bob. Luckily, they share a Bell pair, and that's our entanglement resource. What Alice then needs to do is perform a measurement of on the system that encodes the unknown state together with one half of the Bell pair. So as the result of the measurement will be one of four Bell states. As a result, the entanglement between these two will be lost. Some kind of entanglement will be created here. Now, what Alice needs to do is communicate to Bob what was the outcome of her measurement. In the standard protocol, she needs to communicate 2 bits, so 1, 2, 3, or 4. And then finally, if Bob wants to recreate the original unknown state, he has to do a unitary correction. And then he gets the unknown state. So that's the standard protocol. This is just a little introduction. What's striking to me about teleportation is how different it is from other notions of motion that we think of. So I think about classical motion. It's a nice continuous motion through space-time. Motion due to Schrödinger's equation is also governed by a nice continuous differential equation and so on. Teleportation seems to be disconnected from these notions of motion because it happens possibly over very large distances. So there's a discontinuity there. And we'll see later how we can connect these different notions of motion. So okay, so that's the standard teleportation protocol that everyone's familiar with, but then there's a more recent teleportation protocol called port-based teleportation. Some people know about it, and I'll tell you how that works. So again, just like in the standard protocol, we need entanglement resource. In this case, the entanglement resource is a little bit different. In order for this teleportation protocol to work, you need a lot of shared Bell pairs. Or it doesn't have to be, you know, exactly Bell pairs, depends on what you're doing, but you have to have a lot of shared entanglement resource. So in this case, I show it with n Bell pairs. Again, you need to perform some kind of measurement. So in this case, Alice performs a measurement, a joint measurement of the system that she's trying to teleport together with all of her halves of bell pairs. So it's a kind of big joint measurement. So she then gets n outcomes. That's way less than the dimension of Hilbert space, so it's going to be a lossy measurement. I'll talk about the details in a couple of slides. So the point is that she again has to perform a measurement, only this time measurement is not just on the unknown state and one half of the bell pair, but it's on the unknown state and all of her halves of bell states. So after she performs this measurement, she will get as the outcome one of these numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to n. And she needs to communicate these numbers to Bob. This will not require more bits because there's a lot more bell pairs that are being shared. And once she communicates to Bob what measurement outcome she got, Bob then just chooses one of the qubits on his side. So he just chooses based on the outcome of her measurement, and that's going to be the unknown state. So one thing is that here, Bob doesn't have to perform a unitary correction. He just if these are all qubits, so she's sending a qubit. If these are all qubits, Bob just needs to pick one of the qubits, and it will be in the teleported state. Now, why this works? You are puzzled if you don't know about part-based teleportation. That's you should be puzzled. The reason why this works. You need to go and look into the details of the measurement. So the measurement we perform is essentially a projector onto these bell pairs. So the result of the measurement will be either projecting on these two or any other pair. And if you look at if you remember from the standard teleportation protocol, if you get as a result, so if you have a standard teleportation protocol, you just have this. If accidentally, when Alice performs her measurement, she gets that she projected onto this state, then Bob knows on his side that he doesn't need to perform a unitary correction. So that's in the background of this teleportation protocol, is that we are projecting onto these states. And because there's a large number of shared entanglement, very likely the projection will be successful. And therefore, Bob will not need to perform a unitary correction. He just needs to pick out the right qubit. So
is that why the factor of four goes away? Like, if n is one,
yes,
I have one state in this, but I had four in the first way of doing it, right?
Yes. So here it would be, so here you, instead of comparing 1 to 4, here you need to compare n to 2 to the n. So, okay, so
depends. Yeah, I don't understand why I, like, suppose I just had A1 and A2, then mm-hmm. I could only have two states. Why is it only two states? Why can't I get all the combinations when I do the measurement?
Okay, you mean if you share only one pair?
Well, if you share only one pair, there were four possibilities the other way.
Yes.
So why aren't there eight possibilities or something more if you have just A1 and A2, for example?
Okay, there are. So imagine you want to do part-based teleportation with only one shared bell pair. One quarter of the time, it will work out.
Yeah.
That's the point. But if you have a lot of them, as n goes to infinity, then it's guaranteed that it will work out.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That's the point of port based.
So the idea is you're always going to get the thing that doesn't need the unitary, or you're
exactly
very likely to.
Exactly. Right, so you should use port based teleportation, or you should think about port based teleportation only when you have a lot of shared entanglement resource.
Are you imagining a sequential measurement, like she does the projector onto A1, the bell state, and then if that fails, tries to measure again with the projector onto A1?
No, it's a measurement. It's a joint measurement over the whole big thing. So it's a, if you describe it as as a POVM. Mm-hmm. And POVM operators, I build them here. So first you write down the projector onto these Bell states. And then you, actually it's a pretty good measurement. So you normalize them with this operator. And then it turns out that this is a pretty good measurement. So it means that this is your best chance of distinguishing between the end port, essentially. And yeah, you have to do it over the whole big system at the same time. Okay, so now you raise this question. These operators don't sum up to one, right? And if we had only one shared pair, we would only have a probability 1/4 of succeeding. But even if we have n being a large number, but not infinite, sometimes this protocol will fail. And the way we describe that is by adding to each of these operators a little operator, 1 over n times delta, just to sum up to 1. I think this should be p. And so this leads to two different notions of port-based teleportation. One is the probabilistic protocol, where we describe this extra operator that we need to add to our POVMs as sometimes the protocol fails, so it's probabilistic. Or equivalently, you can describe it as a deterministic protocol, where this loss sometimes loss always leads to less than perfect fidelity of the teleported state, unless of course n is infinite and has to be infinite to do a perfect port-based teleportation.
Do you have like the failure probability as a function of n?
Yes. Yes, yes. There's many papers about that.
Okay.
I'll mention one of them, one of the formulas later.
And to clarify, that's delta over n, that on the left-hand side of that equation.
Yes. Yep. Yes. So this probability of fail or success of port-based teleportation depends on things such as what is the entanglement resource you're sharing. So is it Bell pairs or is it a different kind of entangled states? It also depends on which kind of measurement you use. You don't have to use pretty good measurement. You can use some other measurement protocol. And all of that affects the details of the probability of fail or success. But you know, in general, for sure, the success rate is 1 if n is infinite. OK. So that's the port-based teleportation protocol. Which I'm not going to use in taking this limit. Okay. So this is a picture that I made. Maybe I'll make a better picture in the future. What's the idea here? So imagine you have a quantum state localized approximately in some around a point. Then connected to nearby points in space, there's shared entanglement between these nearby points in space, which we know from entanglement in the quantum field vacuum. So I'll talk about that later. So there, between nearby points in the vacuum of a quantum field in space, there's shared entanglement. Okay, there's a lot of that entanglement. If you don't have a UV cutoff, then there's infinite. Entanglement entropy becomes infinite. But if you take a UV cutoff, then entanglement is large but finite. I will use this entanglement that's found in the vacuum of a quantum field to perform the port-based teleportation protocol.
So what's the black dot of the block again?
So the black dot is just the X.
Just a location,
yeah. It's this
in space.
Yes.
There's not necessarily a particle or even a quantum state there.
There has to be a quantum field.
There's a quantum field.
Yes.
Pervasing everything. So field at X is entangled with the other points.
Yes.
Okay.
The way I describe measurements and so on later is I put a Unruh de Vit detector around here.
Okay.
And Unruh de Vit detector is typically described as a first quantized system, but you know, you can describe it also as an excitation of quantum field. Okay. So the entanglement resource is found in the quantum field vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And the measurements that are also necessary to perform the port-based teleportation are found naturally in the interactions between, for example, an unroot-away detector and the vacuum of the quantum field. So those are the ingredients that go into taking this limit of teleportation between nearby points in space. Okay. So as I said, we know that the vacuum of a free scalar quantum field is an entangled state, which, if you're familiar with this, it can be seen quickly by just looking at the Klein-Gordon equation. If there's no Laplacian in the Klein-Gordon equation, then at every point in space, there is a harmonic oscillator. So then if there was no Laplacian, they would be unentangled. But then there's the Laplacian. The Laplacian couples nearby points, and it couples the harmonic oscillators. So the vacuum of a Klein-Gordon field is an entangled state. And this is a generic feature of quantum fields. So as I said also in the introduction, generically, the entanglement entropy diverges at short distances and falls off quickly as the distance increases. And what we are going to do to look at this infinitesimal limit, we're not going to look at really the details of the entanglement of a quantum field, but just model the entanglement as n-shared belt pairs. So we identify there is a lot of entanglement in the quantum field, and then we model this as n-shared belt pairs at very short distances. So that will be our entanglement resource, just like in the port-based teleportation protocol. Okay, now the second ingredient, as we said, are measurements. For example, because I've worked in relativistic quantum information, I know that I can model interactions between light and matter with this toy model, where an unroot-away detector interacts with a scalar quantum field. I can write down the interaction Hamiltonian. And what I look at is what happens at very short distances over short periods of time. So I make the standard approximation when we are doing light-matter calculations. I take except here, I also take a short period of time to make the connection. So what we see in these interactions between an unroot-away detector and a scalar quantum field, we see that the unroot-away detector is interacting with all modes of the quantum field. There's a lot of interactions going on. So if we trace out the outside of the region that we are focusing on, we can describe that as a measurement. So that goes through, you write down the unitary operator, then you trace out the environment, and you look at the Krauss operators, and you from that you can put the Krauss operators into the Lindblad equation, and so you can quickly start describing the naturally induced measurements that arise from interactions between, for example, unroot-away detector and a scalar quantum field, which, as I said, is just a toy model for light-matter interactions, where light would be described as a quantum electromagnetic field, and matter can be described as a first quantized system or can be described as an excitation of a quantum field.
Is X hat the Pauli X for the UDW?
Yes. Yeah. So, in summary, for this part, we found that in the quantum field's vacuum, there's a lot of entanglement we can use for the port-based teleportation protocol. And in natural interactions between matter and quantum fields, or quantum fields vacuum, we can find the measurements necessary for the port-based teleportation protocol. And then the picture that arises from this is that, so if we are describing things with measurements, is that we get a Brownian motion. Now, what kind of a Brownian motion it is? As we saw, sometimes the port-based teleportation fails if the entanglement resource is finite. That's important because in Brownian motion, if you sometimes have that the system doesn't move or the motion fails, you can describe that as a massive Brownian motion. And then the game that we play here is looking at how the probability of failing scales with the properties of the system being teleported and the properties of entanglement. So in this example, I say that the probability of the port-based teleportation failing is dominantly proportional to D, where D is the size of the teleported state. For example, if the teleported state is a qubit, so we're teleporting a qubit, that would be 2. And here N is the number of entangled pairs. This is valid for when we use EPR pairs or build pairs as the entanglement resource, and I think pretty good measurements. So the details of this can change. This can be without a square root, there can be squares, but this is the general structure is that N is going to be in the denominator, so that when N goes to infinity, the probability of fail goes to 0. Okay, so given that the resulting motion is a Brownian motion, and we identified the probability of failure with the parameters that go into the massive Brownian motion, we can look at what's the relation between different parameters. So on this side, if you're just trying to describe massive Brownian motion, you see that this parameter PS, which is the probability of success, can be related to properties of the grid that the Brownian motion is being performed on and the mass of the particle that's performing the motion. So L would be UV cutoff, D is the dimension of space that the Brownian motion is happening in, and M is the mass of the particle. Okay.
So by particle, do you mean the quantum scalar field? That's what you had in the previous slide. Is M, little m, was the mass of the clock. Is okay. That what the M is?
Thank you for the... So M in this case would be the mass of the particle performing the Brownian motion. So in this case, it would be the system that's being teleported.
So is that the UDW detector?
Exactly. In this case,
so
it would be...
So the UDW detector is being teleported, basically.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
So am I to imagine that there is a UDW detector, like gajillions of them at every point in space? Or like how am I supposed to understand this? Because I usually think of a detector as a localized thing that gets excited or not.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the question. This is the first time I'm talking about this, so I'm trying to patch the story. I mean, I'm trying to tell the story so that people can understand me. So what's happening here is there's a UDW detector at a point, and it's getting teleported. And then you can repeat that process because there's entanglement resource in the quantum field, and there's interactions happening naturally all the time. So the Unruh-De-Witt detector is being teleported towards all its neighboring points, and then again, and then again and again, and the resulting motion is a Brownian motion. That's the idea.
Okay, what I'm missing from this is, I mean, even in the port thing, right, you need an Alice to do the first thing, you need a Bob to pick out the port and do it. So where are all the Bobs here? Like,
okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. So typically, that's a part of the teleportation protocol, is that Alice needs to communicate some classical information to Bob.
Yeah.
Now here, you have things happening between nearby points, and you can imagine this 3D or whichever dimension you like. And there's a lot of shared entanglement. So one detail that I haven't mentioned, and it's an important detail, is that the teleported state goes into one of the degrees of freedom of the quantum field. So in some sense, this analysis is only self-consistent if I really model the Unruh-De-Witt detector as an excitation of a quantum field. Okay, so what happens is when the teleportation happens, this unknown state goes into one of the degrees of freedom of the quantum field. There's no communication of classical information because it's not necessary. It doesn't matter which of the degrees of freedom of the quantum field got the information, it's just there.
Who's doing the measurement then? Like somebody's tracing something, but who's doing that?
The measurement is the natural induced measurement that arises from interactions between the system, so the unrelated detector, is interacting with the quantum field. There's an interaction there that I don't need to put in by hand. It's just happening naturally. So that's the quantum operation that's performing the teleportation.
So the UDW detector is one field. Then there's the other quantum field it couples to. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And then somehow the fact that they're interacting via this port thing induces a Brownian motion on the UDW guy.
Yes.
That's and sorry, I asked before, little m is the m of the QF or the UDW? I forget.
Of the QF or the UDW? Okay,
is it the mass of the Klein-Gordon on the previous, or is it the mass of the UDW?
This would be the parameter in the Brownian motion. So it would be the mass of the UDW detector that would arise because of this the motion.
So if
that
I
makes
had
sense.
A massless quantum field or scalar field, then this would still work or not?
It would still work. You would just have to look at the details of taking the limit. Careful.
All right. Why is it the mass of the thing that you're telling? I would have guessed that if I'm making many measurements that determines how quickly this thing kind of diffuses, it's going to be how long range the entanglement tends to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so why isn't it only dependent on that? Like, why would it depend on the mass of the detector? Because it's just the thing you're teleporting, whereas what you would think would matter is how quickly you're performing these measurements and how long range your entanglement is, and only on those two things.
So I'm not sure. So it does depend on how quickly things are evolving. It does depend on the details of these interactions. So it should also in general depend on the nature of entanglement. I am here modeling it as a simple model of just, I have, you know, between nearby points, I have a lot of shared Bell pairs. So maybe this is confusing, this parameter M. It's just when you have a diffusive motion and there's a probability that the at each point in time that the jump doesn't happen, then that's described as a massive Brownian motion, which looks like a Klein-Gordon equation.
Well, I mean, if I am doing arithmetic right, P goes like 1 over 1 plus M squared. So the bigger the M, the less successful you are, which makes sense to me. It's harder to teleport a heavy thing.
Yes.
But I do have sympathy with this question because it should also depend on separation. Should it?
Right? Why is it harder to teleport a heavy thing?
Inertia. It's harder to move.
You're teleporting the information.
Well, that's of course the interesting question. Well, I mean, if when I think of motion, it's harder to move heavy things.
Yeah.
You're quite right. I mean, information isn't massive in that sense. So in that sense, I agree with you. But if I'm just thinking about moving something, a heavier thing should be harder to move.
Yeah, I agree. I think Jonathan's question is valid, but it's just I don't answer it here because I'm not modeling entanglement in details. I'm just modeling it as shared Bell pairs between nearby points, and then you cannot say anything about long-range entanglement there. Then you need to look into more details
about it. Why doesn't a distance scale appear? I mean, there's a cutoff length,
mm-hmm.
but why isn't there a separation scale in the Brownian motion?
The
points could be a million miles apart, or
the point is that I'm trying to look at teleportation between nearby points. That's
yeah, but
the idea.
How does the nearbyness come into the formula? That's what.
Oh, the UV cutoff.
UV cutoff is ensuring.
Well, I'm calling this UV cutoff.
All right.
Just to clarify on yes. the part-based teleportation, it sounded like you were saying that LS communicates 2 to the n One out of two to be implausible is
false. She would have to, in the typical way that we think about port based on prediction.
But if only one port can ever be sort of used as the one that's teleported to,
yes.
Isn't it more like one of n? Because I want to make sure that we don't have any broadcasting that in this motion it moves to one port as opposed to.
Oh, you're right, you're right. Yeah, yeah, you're right. I mixed up 2 to the n and n. You're right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's n. Then I would have to do a log n to talk about to do something. Yeah. Sorry, that's true. So it is n.
Sorry,
I was talking about bits though. So. Yeah, okay, anyway, there's some log going on there.
Is it equally likely to go to all the ports? So it's like very diffuse motion in all directions equally?
Yes. Yeah, that's the idea. That's why I'm talking about Brownian motion.
Why
here.
Brownian, because it can yeah. go all over the place.
Yes, so let me just move on. So these are all good questions. I hope that we clarified at least some of them. So. Assuming that n is very large, success probability is close to 1. And in that limit, we'll have a diffusion equation, a standard diffusion equation. And then from the parameters of the port-based teleportation matching to the diffusion equation, we find that the diffusion constant somehow depends on the, is proportional to D, where D is the dimension of the state being teleported, again for a qubit it's 2, to some power A, positive power A, divided by N, and again is the number of shared Bell pairs, to some positive power B. Okay. And then, because what we derived here is just classic, some kind of classical Brownian motion, and we are trying to connect that to quantum physics, so classical Brownian motion is not satisfactory. Well, how do we go beyond the classical motion? So recall that we modeled the board-based teleportation with measurements. And then so that's the standard protocol, and you have to perform a measurement in order to teleport the state. And that gave rise to the classical motion. But that's not the fundamental thing that's going on in the interaction between a vacuum and a particle, the measurements are actually unitary interactions. So what we need to do is purify the measurements into unitary interaction, and then we get a quantum random walk. Okay, and then we can match the parameters of the port-based teleportation to the parameters that we get from, for example, Schrödinger's equation. That's the general idea. And then, interestingly, we get something like that reduced Planck constant. So we know what reduced Planck constant is because we know what Schrödinger's equation is proportional to something like 1 over n to a positive power. And n we get from the port-based teleportation protocol. So it looks in this analysis like the reduced Planck constant is a measure of amount of entanglement that we can find in the quantum field. One thing that needs to be discussed here is, so you might be suspicious about h-bar arising here as just a measure of the entanglement of the quantum field because we derived it by introducing entanglement of a quantum field, measure interactions with the quantum field and so on. All of these things have h-bars in them. So why am I being so bold to say that h-bar is something else? So the reason is that this number, n, it comes from the probability of failure and of the port-based teleportation protocol. Now, a probability is derived from the Born rule. And Born rule is just a probabilistic thing. It doesn't have h-bar in it. The h-bar might come into play because it contains some unitary interactions, quantum states, and so on. But this n here, it's the n comes just from n is basically something that determines the probability of success of a port-based teleportation, and there's no h bar there. Okay, we can discuss that. I hope I managed to explain what I mean. So, what I like about this idea is that once you take the limit of teleportation over small distances, you can derive from it a Brownian motion, which you can then purify into Schrodinger equation, Klein-Gordon equation, which seems to connect the two notions of motion, which to me seemed disconnected up until now. So teleportation, disconnect teleportation with motion due to continuous differential equations. And of course, if you take the limit, it also connects teleportation to just classical motion. If you take the limit of quantum mechanics to classical mechanics. Okay, so I just mentioned this already, that H-bar's connection to the amount of entanglement in the quantum field comes from the Born rule, not from the details of interactions between matter and quantum field. Before I say ideas for the outlook, I'll just mention that this is related to Nelson's. So this is old work by Nelson from Princeton. He has the derivation of the Schrödinger equation. And in his derivation, he poses that there's a natural diffusion constant that comes from something fundamental in nature. And here, what we do is we connect that diffusion constant that he just posited to this naturally occurring teleportation that happens over small distances. So in some sense, this is an extension of work of Nelson. And I think this has a lot of potential for future work. I'll just mention one of them. I think it could be possible that this helps us tackle the problem of back reaction in general relativity. So the idea here is that we just saw that entanglement in the vacuum affects classical motion. So it affects Schrödinger's equation, so on. But by extension, it also affects classical motion. In the opposite direction, motion also affects entanglement. So what we didn't discuss is that once you perform one teleportation, that uses up some entanglement resource. The bigger the system that you're teleporting, the more entanglement resource you need to use. So in some sense, the bigger the system that that is being teleported, the more it affects the entanglement in the quantum field. And the way entanglement is affected each time you perform a port-based teleportation protocol is quantifiable. People have done work on that. You can look at, for example, how to recycle entanglement resource in the port-based teleportation protocol. So this might be a way to approach the problem of back reaction in general relativity. And there's many more things to discuss, but I just wanted to mention this. And I think for this part of the talk, I'm done. We can go to questions. Sorry. No, go.
No, I asked a lot.
I have two questions. The first one is just to make sure I understand right. So in the QFT, I guess the entanglement has an area law. So should I imagine that N is sort of goes like an area? So there's like a one bell pair for each point on the area surrounding X. And so when I pick one of these pairs, that's like picking the direction that I'm moving the
So I think what you're talking about is if I calculate the entanglement entropy of this region, then it scales as the area. And basically, it measures how many APR pairs I've cut, right? Okay, but then you can imagine that there are APR pairs between this point and every other point around it. So connecting one point and another point is many EPR pairs. So one EPR pair doesn't mean one direction, if that makes sense.
Okay. The other question was, so the large, if you have large N of N entangled, N bell pairs, then the algebra accessible to Alice is a type 2 algebra, whereas in QFTs, the algebra is a type 3. So you would get a type 3 algebra if they were less than maximally entangled pairs of qubits. So I was wondering if you'd gone to that case to see.
Okay, so you're saying if I look at the way we normally think of quantum field theory, this would be a type 3 algebra, and then n would be infinite, right? Yes. So in that case, the probability of success would always be. I don't go into details of that. Yes, if I take n to be finite, then it's I think it's type 1 then, because it's a finite dimensional system.
If you took n infinite and the qubit pairs weren't Bell pairs but like less than maximally entangled, then you'd get a type 3.
Right.
In which case, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would change things.
Yes, I don't go into that. I just keep things at finite. And then if you take a limit, there might be some sophisticated details that come from the fact it's infinite amount of Bell pairs. Then you might be able to make even better conclusions, but I haven't done that. I just kept things finite.
Thank you.
Finite but large.
So you said they aren't, there's no transmission of classical information between like this point.
Yeah.
So like, intuitively, it feels weird because, like, you just share entanglement with no transmission information, and so there's like a no signaling sort of principle.
Okay.
And then you would like replace Bob with just a random coin flip at every point in space because the shared entanglement can't be utilized.
I think on the flip side of that, we can think of this. This is an explanation why no signaling, no faster than light signaling works.
Well, I didn't mean no faster than light. I meant like just shared entanglements alone can't be used to transmit information, like regardless of the speed. Right?
So yes, you have entanglement, but you also have the interactions. So they are moving things around.
So would you say that the interactions like mediating transmission of information in some way? Is there a way to quantify that?
So there's shared entanglement, and then there's interactions between, let's say, unrooted detector and the quantum field, and that's what's spreading things around. And what's missing in the exact matching to the port-based teleportation protocol is the classical communication. But I think I haven't thought about this too much. But to me, it seems like this might be an explanation of why you cannot send. Information faster than classically is because already there's an implicit I don't know how to phrase that.
Implicit speed limit.
Yeah, I haven't worked that out yet. You know, the connection to speed of light and so on. That's in the future work, but I think this connection between teleportation at infinitesimal distances and propagation of information due to Schrödinger's equation, classical motion, and so on. This connection between them could be an explanation of why there is no faster than light signal. That's what I'm trying to say, yes.
So yeah, can you go backwards a couple of slides, please? I mean, I had similar questions. Yeah, maybe one more. Yeah, so I had similar questions about Bob, but putting that aside, so when this happens a lot, we get this diffusion thing, and then somehow it's connected with H bar, except that there's no I on the left-hand side. So where's that going to come from?
That comes from the purification. So the reason why you get the classical diffusion equation here is because what's happening is just classical jumps induced by. And the reason why they are classical jumps is because we are modeling interactions with measurements. Now, when you purify those measurements into unitary interactions, then you get the quantum description.
Have you verified that explicitly, or is this an expectation at this point in time?
I don't want to say 100%, but it's looking pretty good.
Okay.
Yes.
So, probably.
Yes. Right.
The other thing is you're connecting with H bar, but N is unitless and H bar isn't. So you're going to need some. How are the units of action going to come into the problem?
Yes. Okay. So let me just say for the previous question. So one thing is if you have a quantum random walk. I'm just going back. so that if you have a quantum random walk and you decohere the coin, for example, then you get back a classical diffusion. There, so I mean, there's this is probably going to work out in details. So the other question is, where do the constants? Yes, that's a good question. So yeah, this is a dimensionful constant, and this is not. So that's a good question. I wish I had my calculations here now. There's in this calculation, if I remember correctly, there's speed of light in there. So if I want to connect some parameters, there's speed of light.
Units of energy and time or something.
Right. Yes. So there are some units in there. And then for that, I referred to the paper because I don't have the details right now.
But you've connected this dimensionally. That you made that proportionality inequality then with other dimensions.
Yes, you can make it an equality. Yes.
Okay,
I just here is just a, as a picture, you know, to say, oh, this is what this is proportional to.
But still, you need. I mean, unless you. If you're not allowed to use Newton's constant, it's still a bit hard for me to see, right? I mean, you've got h bar c and a length. Maybe you could do it. No.
Yeah.
H bar c is an energy length, so you can divide by the length to get an energy. But I don't know how you're going to get rid of the energy. It's a bit, unless you put in the mass or something.
C squared. Give me the details. I would like to just write down on paper.
Well, I'd be interested in seeing that. I mean,
yes.
It's an interesting idea, but it does seem there's a few gaps.
Sure, there's gaps. Yeah, that's why I prefaced it by saying that, you know, this is new. The paper is actually not out yet, so I just wanted to share this story with you, basically.
Okay, I have a question. Perhaps this is my lack of understanding of relativistic quantum information, but there is this detector.
Mm-hmm.
And you said the detector is modeled by some quantum degrees of freedom, and that's it. But shouldn't the detector be classical by construction to be consistent with the Heisenberg cut?
With the Heisenberg cut? Aha, okay. So the way it works in UNRU physics is that, so the UNRU David detector is a two-level quantum system. It interacts with the scalar quantum field with some kind of, so everything is fine, some interaction Hamiltonian. And then you look at what the state of the detector is at the end of the interaction. So typically maybe you have them interact between minus infinity in time to plus infinity in time, and then you look at the state of the detector at the end. So that's when it becomes classical because you're performing measurements on it. But during the interaction with the quantum field, it's a quantum object.
So you might, so the detector itself is not measuring. So somebody else measures the detector.
Yeah. So if you want to look at you know, what I'll call UNRU physics, like the fact that there's a thermal state associated with accelerated motion and so on, you can describe that with Bogolyubov transformation and so on.
Uh-huh.
The reason why people came up with this model, presumably UNRU and David, came up with this model is to see physically what's going on. How does the detector pick up the radiation from the field and then which state it ends up in and so on. So yeah, it's a model of a quantum detector that you then at the end of the interaction with the quantum field, you check its state and you see what state it's in.
And who is checking the field?
Who's checking the field? You can also, if you want, you can also measure the excitations in the field.
But I mean, there has to be an external agent that measures.
Yes. So there's. It's even worse because in typical description of the UNRU David detector, it's a two-level quantum system that's accelerating. It's actually typically described as moving on a classical trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
So there's even an agent that's forcing it to go on a certain classical trajectory. But
here,
it's all in the usual thing.
In the usual thing.
It's different.
So there's no classical measurement here.
There's no classical measurement. So I think what Thier was asking about is you're talking about the detector measuring the quantum field. But the measurements I'm talking about is the measurements that arise from their interactions.
Uh-huh.
So this is going to be a unitary evolution that arises from their interaction. And then the measurement that I need for the port-based teleportation protocol, I get from tracing out this unitary interaction to the small region where the teleportation is happening.
And that all happens before the root of it detector is measured.
Yeah, the root of it detector in this protocol is not going to be measured. It's just a model for the interaction between a quantum system and the quantum field.
I see.
Yeah,
so it's not
sorry.
A
sorry for not making that clear.
Can you do teleportation without the classical measurement?
Yes, then it becomes, so if when you take this unitary operator and then you model it as a measurement locally because you're tracing out the environment and so on, then, as I said, you get classical Brownian motion. The way you get the purified version of that, so some quantum random walk, is by keeping the unitary, keeping the interaction unitary.
So I'm still confused, but it just reminds me of other debates where just predicting the probability of something, if you were to measure it, and measuring it is different. Like in these Wigner friend scenarios, you can say, okay, the probability would be this, but unless you actually measure it, and things are different, no? And here there is no classical register of this interaction happening. It's kind of
That's fine,
so
because
I'm just confused about all
this. Okay, that's actually fine, because fundamentally what's happening is not a measurement, it's a unitary interaction. So we don't even have to talk about someone keeping a register of what's happened.
So if this, you know, if the gaps get filled in and so on, ultimately this means that the original UDW detector, its motion is really Schrodinger motion of a wave function. It becomes a quantum particle.
Yes,
is that right?
Exactly, yes.
As opposed to a classical one.
Yes.
So the idea is this is a different way of looking at the origin of Schrodinger's equation.
That's why I mentioned Nelson, because Nelson actually derives the Schrodinger equation, but it just posits H bar, so on, that it exists. But here we might see the origin of what's producing this diffusive motion that then produces Schrodinger equation.
So then with the picture, like we've got bajillions of quantum particles in the world that obey Schrodinger's equation. So is there some sort of universal quantum field in this picture? Would there be some sort of universal quantum field to which they all couple to in this manner that's causing this?
Yeah, I mean, the quantum field of the standard model, whatever is around us is the quantum field that's being coupled to.
Okay, so one other thing. If the in this model here, the UDW, you said, ultimately has to be a quantum field, and it's coupling to another quantum field. But the coupling is linear, and what you can always do in QFT is I've got a linear interaction between a pair of fields. I can diagonalize and decouple them. So what would that mean here? Right, it's got like the action is a something a squared, something ab, and something b squared. So you can always do a minus b, a plus b.
You're saying that
that's what particle physicists do, right? They diagonalize quantum fields so you can get properly massive states and so on.
Okay, but sorry. You're saying something like this. So if I look at interactions between nearby points, clearly they are coupled. I don't know if this is what you're saying.
Saying the UDW field interaction is a linear interaction.
Yeah.
And then if the UDW itself is a quantum field, then I could go to a basis where I diagonalize those quantum fields and remove that linear interaction effectively.
But what is that basis? Is it both position basis? Because the description of motion and position basis is what we are talking about here.
So there's some sort of preferred basis.
Yeah, I mean, yes, this is not a, you know, hugely ambitious project where I'm trying to do quantum gravity and so on. This is really what's the origin of Schrodinger equation or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else have questions?
Just quickly, are you always considering short-range entanglement here? Or?
Yeah, so I'm just saying, I'm saying that without... there's all kinds of entanglement going on in the quantum field, so it depends also on the quantum field. Here I introduced it as a Klein-Gordon, and I said I can model that to a good approximation as having between each between two points that are nearby a lot of shared bell pairs.
So if you had a field with long-range entanglement, would you get some diffusion over very long distances.
Yeah, I suppose there would be something like that happening, but for that, you would not just need a shared entanglement between those distant points, you would have to also have a interaction, which is not the standard kind of interactions in quantum fields are local. So one of the things here is that because these are nearby points, you have local interactions.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I'm trying to understand sort of successive applications of this unitary that you're describing. It seems like for one of them, you have this like one to n type connection, which is that there's one particle that gets teleported, but of course it could end up in any one of the modes elsewhere. And now successively, next round, for the site that it got teleported to, which one is being teleported?
All of them, just like in Brownian motion.
Then I'm just wondering, like, can you teleport n positions in a port-based teleportation using n pairs? No.
N positions.
Right. So, like, if you have because since you don't know where it is,
yeah,
you teleport them all.
One of the things, so there is one, so there is, you imagine there is one UNRWD detector.
Mm-hmm.
We can go into details, but let's say there's one UNRWD detector. So it starts in this point. Then due to the presence of entanglement and interactions with the quantum field, let's say we are describing a two-dimensional thing, then it gets diffused into these nearby points.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a probabilistic thing, we don't know which ones. So then in the next iteration, you have to describe jumps from each of them, but it's probabilistic. So it's just like Brownian motion. Now, if you're asking about the quantum case is similar. So again, at each step, you're performing a unitary operator, which.
And would it be the case that these sort of the unitary operators across different sites commute, like on a grid, if you had 3x3, 4x4 grid, you could take two of the spots in the middle and write down.
Let me think. So you mean for the quantum random walk? So the quantum random walk operator typically, so for one dimension, it looks like this. So something like that. So this is the coin. You're flipping some kind of a quantum coin. That's a Hadamard operator. And then these S are the things that move the particle around. So they do something like that.
Okay.
And
that's PR and PL, left, right, and left.
Yes, so that means, you know, projector like this, projector like that.
Okay.
And Hadamard. Yeah. So this is what this unitary that makes a quantum random walk looks like. If you decohere, for example, the coin, you can also decohere this part of the quantum random walk. But if you decohere one of them, then you go into classical random walk.
Okay, and just lastly, you're finding that h bar is sort of proportional to 1 over n.
Mm-hmm.
And just intuitively, I would have expected that models which have a lot of entanglement could give you like a large value of h bar, and models which have, you know, no entanglement would sort of think that the classical limit where h bar goes to zero, but you're seeing exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, there's contradictory intuitions. For example, Planck length has h bar here. No, I don't want to reveal. I think it's like this. So for me, if h bar goes to zero, it makes sense that Planck length goes to zero. Then I get a nice classical smooth space time. That's also consistent with intuition from, what did they call them? Alex May works on this, so you can do non-local operations and make them look like local operations. They use port-based teleportation protocol. He actually told me about this protocol. So there you learn that if you have a lot of entanglement resource, if you have infinite entanglement resource, you can perfectly reproduce local operations. And that's consistent with this again, because if you have a very large n, then h-bar goes to zero, Planck length goes to zero, and then local is the same as a lot of entanglement. So I don't know exactly what the answer to your question is, but yeah.
All right. any questions from PhD students? No? OK. Then let's thank Bhavana for a really interesting talk.